Blog Talk Radio.
From the deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, the SRI Label Group, Wildlife Educational Services, and Blog Talk Radio present Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover with us the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we discover his wild world.
Well, this is Larry Batson. Welcome to Wild World on this magical network called Blog Talk Radio. And a few technical difficulties this afternoon, but we're rolling now. Our guest today is going to be Yellowstone Park Ranger Bob Jackson. And as always, from the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, the honorable, distinguished, and always on time, Dr. Henry Day. Good afternoon, Doc.
Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Batson. The Taliban messing with the airwaves again?
Yeah, I think so. But we got it figured out, so we're cool. We're cool. Absolutely.
Well, so Bob Jackson is absolutely one of my favorite guests on the show.
I know. One of mine as well, if not the favorite guest. And he's always phenomenal. And today, Dr. Day, we're going
to
be
talking. My head is swelling up, guys. It's just too big right now.
We're going to talk about his adventures with poachers, so that should be an interesting hour of Blog Talk Radio, without a doubt. So you ready, Dr. Day?
Yeah, let's scamper through this so we can get Bob on.
All right, here we go.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
All right, we're going to start off in Santa Barbara, California today. The sea monster has been identified. A big sea creature that washed ashore in Southern California has been identified as a hoodwinker sunfish. Yes, a hoodwinker sunfish. That's what washed up on the shore. Now, a recently identified rare species that was thought to live in the Southern Hemisphere, but it washed
I
up
saw
in Santa
that.
Barbara.
Yeah, I saw that, Dr. Day. That was when they first couldn't figure out what it was. That was kind of disturbing to some degree. But I'm sure there's
many of them. Yeah, you've never seen a sunfish. They are quite an interesting character.
Oh, and Dr. Day has. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, when
okay.
I used to live in Panama. Yeah. All right, now you'll relate to this next story. There are easier ways to become a celebrity. Phoenix, Arizona. Welder Samuel Evans, if you hear a little noise in the background, the African Cree is in the studio with me today.
Oh, cool. Fantastic.
Well, Welder Samuel Evans unexpectedly became a medical celebrity after he was bitten on his right thumb by a rattlesnake while hiking this last weekend in White Tank Mountain Regional Park.
What state's that?
That's in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Now, outside of clinical trials, Evans is the first patient in the United States to be treated with a new rattlesnake anti-venom.
Well, how did it work? Did they know yet?
Yeah, he's doing great. You've had an experience like that before.
I did. I was in St. Louis, Missouri, doing shows, and I was bitten by about a 6-foot timber rattlesnake, and it was quite an adventure, I'll tell you, between the intensive care and the emergency room and some of the procedures they go through for snake bite. And the thing about St. Louis, Missouri is they don't see that very often, so it was basically they're reading out of a cookbook on what to do for me next. And one of the things that they wanted to make sure that they did for me determine whether I was allergic to the antivenin that counteracts the snake bite. The only problem with it, the whole deal was, is they gave me enough antivenin for an elephant. And about 4 days after I was at the hospital, I broke out in hives. It was terrible.
Why didn't they do what the Western movies, you know, you just cut an X and then you suck on it. Yeah, that's what I grew up thinking.
Well, there's only one problem with that, Bob, is that happened in Florida one time, and the guy that was doing the first aid had a cavity in one of his back molars.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah, and the venom went right to that cavity and killed the guy that was trying to do the first aid.
Wow, I mean, I was only joking, of course, but at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something to hear that, yeah.
Exactly. Absolutely. And it's just like you don't treat it with ice. What I did, I was told later, was the smartest thing, is just kind of let the venom go through your body and get to the hospital as quick as you can and let them take over from there. So it's very uncomfortable. I didn't really have any. The only effects I heard about later was they treated me with lots of cortisone, which I think has contributed to my arthritis later in my life. So, but anyway.
Did you live?
No, I didn't live. It was a fatality.
All right, now this sounds like a bad sci-fi movie. Lincoln, Nebraska. Experts are concerned about the potential threat posed to the agriculture in the state by an invasive worm from Asia. Yeah, listen to this. The Asia jumping worms can deplete the soil of nutrients, damage plant roots, and alter the soil's capacity to hold water. Asian jumping worms.
Well, they shouldn't leave Asia. That's the problem. We've had some. I'm sure Bob Jackson could tell you a million things that have been coming from different countries and things that have caused such horrible effects on our environment. I mean, it's endless. Terrible.
Yeah, I can tell you about jumping worms in Iowa. When I was growing up, we had a Baptist. We had a big tank in the church where you get dunked, you know. And so that sprung too many leaks, and so we put it out there on the farm. And us kids, us boys, found out that what you do is you pound on the side of that thing, and then all these night crawlers just come out as fast as you can imagine. I mean, earthworms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it's because of the shake and the vibration in there. But that's a great way to, every time, to get worms to go fishing, is just bang on the side of that big old, I guess it had a couple lives of the dunking. That way, you got dunked in the one, and then you dunked it again. Yes. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder if they if it sounded like thunder to them.
I think it was the vibrations, but I don't know. Maybe thunder is vibrations. I don't know.
Well.
Right. Interesting.
Well, that is.
We'll get our wildlife crew on that.
Yes,
now,
we will.
Mr. Babson, you're a professional dung wrangler, aren't you?
Pretty much,
yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen to this. The Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Gardens has become the repository for the world's largest collection of polar bear poop. Yeah, as researchers work to create a pregnancy test to aid the species survival.
So, you know, that bear dung's very, very fertile. You know, I tell the story about with our black bears that we'd feed them watermelon and cantaloupe, and of course it goes, you know, they just goes through their system, and the seeds get deposited in the dung, of course. So. One summer, Cheryl, my wife, was at her garden. She was growing melons and watermelons and so forth, and they were doing pretty good. But I walked by the dung pile for the bears that we dumped in the woods, and I tripped over something. At first, I thought it was a telephone cable. Oh, no, it was the vine from one of these cantaloupe that had grown out of the bear dung. I'll tell you right now, it was the most beautiful, big cantaloupe. And anyone that I gave it to, I had to tell them. I said, "This has never touched Mother Earth." Works it off really well, and they tell me, they say that those are the best cantaloupes. So then, here's what my idea, Bob and Kenny, was. I thought, here's what we need to do: we get like an ice cream container, and put the bear poop in there with the watermelon seeds, or, you know, to sell different flavors, watermelon, cantaloupe, where basically people just go home, open up the can and dump it on their garden and walk away from it. It's done. There's no planting. That's it. And they'll get these huge watermelon cantaloupes.
Yeah, it would be a surprise. You never know what's going to grow.
Well, you know, in Yellowstone, the bear biologists and us, we'd go in the, we'd gather up those grizzly scats, but they'd always wear plastic gloves because they said the bears always had parasites, worms, in the scat. Mm-hmm. So that was like the big thing you had to be careful of. But I did want to add one thing about what's in bear poop. If you go in the real high countries where the elk calves and their mothers, you know, there'd maybe be 300 or 400 of those clear up high up onto the Alpine tundra or the Trident or up on what's Two Ocean Plateau. And those big boars, the big badass boars, that's where the, that was their home. And they'd have little day areas where they'd stay underneath these little scrubby pine that were like 3-4 feet high, maybe 5 feet. And it'd be dark in there, and you, that'd be where the bears, those big boars, would stay. You'd have to watch to make sure you didn't ride anywhere close to any of those scrub areas because if they're sleeping in there. But outside those areas where they're sleeping, then you would find their scats. And, of course, big boars have big scat. And they'd have full hooves, you know, from these elk calves that they'd eat. And that whole hoof would come through. Yeah, you know.
Wow.
It was really weird. I got pictures of it. Yeah. Anyway, off the subject. Go ahead.
What do their intestines have to be? My God. Jesus.
I know. Well, the little calves aren't that big, but still, you know, it's probably a little bit smaller than a... Oh, it would be like the size of a lemon or an orange. Yeah,
yeah,
be going through their system. Yeah.
Man, that's incredible. Okay,
right, well, I'm glad we got Bob on the phone today because he can probably answer this question. Listen to this. How much money did they spend on this research? Spokane, Washington. Researchers at the University of Washington say white-tailed deer and mule deer react differently when hungry wolves are around.
Yeah.
Well,
white-tailed deer, of course, are usually down lower elevations near the willows and everything else, and your mule deers would be up a little higher. So I would say that probably, not knowing, but white-tailed deer probably a little more secretive and moving around through all those scrub brush willows and things like that, whereas if you're a mule deer, you basically got to get out of that sagebrush and then try to get up into maybe some woods, kind of like elk do in Yellowstone, when the wolf packs are come by, you know, they get out of the openings and get up into the woods, those cow-calf groups do. Am I right or wrong? What did they do? What's your answer?
Well, my answer is they should have called you first instead of spending all that money.
Yeah. Oh, I see. That was what they were spending the money on, is trying to figure out how they did do it differently.
Yeah.
Mine's only anecdotal, though. You know, you got pure research, and, you know, you got your hypothesis, your theory, and then your fact. And so anecdotal, like everything I know, doesn't really count, nor does yours, Larry, but Dr. Day, his probably does count. So.
Well, no, that's true. That's absolutely true.
You never know.
Yeah.
All right, Mendon, Utah. State wildlife officials have corralled more than 500 wild turkeys this winter in Cache County and have moved them to the Book Hills. So if you haven't seen any of your family or neighbors about, head out to Book Cliffs. They might be wandering around out there. to those people in Coates, North Carolina, who apprehended 3 North American river otters. We want them back.
Yes, we do.
The animal sanctuary says 3 North American river otters were taken from the facility there. Now, first off, you're going to need a lot of water. They eat a lot of fish, and they bite really hard.
Yeah.
And they're not yours. So take them back.
How did they get them out of there? That's my question. Gosh, because river otters aren't little.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, the last animal taken from a zoo was taken out in a baby carriage.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
In Yellowstone, you'll see them climb out of Yellowstone Lake up onto the sides of those mountains. Evidently, when they've had a lot of trout to eat after that, they're just having fun, of course. They always love to have fun, otters do. And they'll go way up there, just, you know, bounding clear up there, and then every one of them, then all at once slide all the way down into the water. I mean, it's like the hugest water park of all, what those otters do. And, of course, as far as tough, yeah, I've seen them, those adult otters, and, of course, you know, they fight off the coyotes pretty easily. It's hard for a coyote to get a otter.
Well, I would think the size enough, too. I mean, maybe occasional mountain lion, but, gosh,
Our farm here in Iowa, southern Iowa, which is a lot of oak savanna and prairie, and we got some really good oxbows in through here, what you wouldn't think would be in Iowa. But this is the first place that they reintroduced otter in the state, is right down below our place here on the Army Corps ground. And that was probably 20 years ago. But so we have otter that's always, they den right in our ponds or right above them on the banks. But we got 48 farm ponds on our land.
Oh, man.
So,
wow.
So the otters, they'll go from one to the next. But most of the time they don't fish them out. As long as you got a lot of structure in the ponds,
mm-hmm.
and those fish know to get into there. So. But otherwise, all the farmers around here, they hate otter because they clean out the ponds. Well,
yeah.
It's because there's nothing in there except for bare bottoms. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the otter's fault.
Yeah. They were there first.
Yeah, it's well.
All right.
Yeah.
Bismarck, North Dakota. American Indian students in the state will be allowed to wear eagle feathers or plumes at school graduations under a measure being considered by the legislature there.
Well,
Only American Indians, though.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's true with all your birds of prey feathers. Can't have them, you know, unless you're a Native American.
That's right.
Can't do that. The birds are protected. Bob will tell you.
Easter is almost here. Now listen to this, Palsbo, Washington. The Kitsap Humane Society staff have taken in about 300 rabbits from a homeowner overwhelmed by their breeding. Yeah, she bought a pair of bunnies, took them home.
And guess what?
Now, the gestation period for a rabbit is about 31 days. Let's think about it. Easter is almost here. Let's think about the, you know, the bunnies and the baby chicks.
True.
If you can't take care of them, please don't. All right, we're walking with dinosaurs in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. A volunteer at the Valley Forge National Historical Park recently discovered dozens of fossilized dinosaur footprints on the flat rocks that they had used to pave a trail there.
Well, that's cool.
They are quite excited about it. All right, local news. Let's do the local news. Right now, it's pothole season in Indiana. Yes.
Yeah.
So make sure you have the right ammunition. And let the state know how you feel about the potholes.
I wonder if they have
I
was getting ready to say, I wonder if they have a pothole problem in England.
Well, you never know.
Well, let's check in there.
You're welcome here to Dave. We got you, Dave.
Oh, you know, we do this every week. I'm always here. You always ask me, Dave, you there? I'm always listening. I'm always listening. You know, you can see me right there on the computer. Right?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, I heard you talking about the potholes. That's not very fun. Potholes aren't fun.
No.
Now, I don't talk to my brother Ray that much, but we text each other. And I have a question for you. Would you rather be stuck on a cliff with a lovesick vulture, or yawny.
Can you repeat those options again, Dave?
That would be a lovesick vulture or yawny.
Oh, that's a tough one. I just don't know, Dave. Man, you asked the hardest questions. What do you think, Bob?
I couldn't really. I wasn't listening in that close, so I'm just going to abstain and pass it back to you.
Dave, I'll go with A. That's what I'll say.
Love six vultures then, okay. That's all we wanted to know. Thanks, all right. I'll keep listening.
Okay. Good. His insight's amazing. Bob probably doesn't realize who Dave Davies is.
I don't know, Bob.
Bob?
Yeah, you're talking? Hey, I've gone to sleep. Not really. Oh. Go ahead. Yeah,
no,
I didn't know who was talking to who. I didn't know who
was
talking to who there.
That's all right. I was saying that Bob probably doesn't even know who Dave Davies is.
Who? What is?
Yeah, see, I know. Dave Davies is the lead guitar player of a band from England called The Kinks. It also has.
Really? No, I don't.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
I know Billy Idol from England.
Yeah, there you go.
Bob just spent too much time in the woods without a radio.
Yes, he did. Absolutely, yeah.
Actually, where I was, there was no reception for AM, FM. Trail Crew, that was back in the early 70s. There was always a wire that was connected probably about 40 feet up a tree, and that would go about another 150 feet to another tree, and Trail Crew would come in, and they'd climb that, and they'd attach a wire to their radio, their AM, FM, and then they could get classical music out of Jackson Hole. But that's the only AM, FM that I ever knew ever was available, you know, that far back, 30-some miles in any road. No, we didn't have any. I didn't even know about the September 11th, the Trade Center, until 2 days later, and that was somebody riding in, and they told us. The only thing I knew is there was no more, where the jet or the airplanes, the commercial, would leave the streams up in the sky. And that'd be three, 4 times a day, and you always were irritated seeing those. And for a couple of days, I didn't see any, and I thought, what the heck is going on here? So anyway, it would travel by horse instead of by radio.
Yeah, wow. That just makes you realize there's still wild, wild country in this country of ours. My gosh, wouldn't have thought it.
Yeah.
All right, I think since we're running a little short today, we'll skip the who's gotten older, and I'll do the fact of the day, and we'll throw Bob out there, okay?
All right.
All right, let me give you the fact of the day. Sharks never run out of teeth. They have new ones on a conveyor belt at the ready to move up and replace any that become lost during feeding. Now, some sharks can produce over 30,000 teeth in their lifetime.
Wow.
Incredible.
Yeah. And that's the Wild World News for March 10th.
Well, once again, a great job done by Dr. Henry Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana. All HD absolutely sounds fantastic there with his bird and everything. I want to remind everyone this is brought to you by our underwriter, SRIRecords.com. SRI Label Group, they have it all, rock, country, jazz, blues, it's all there. Their CEO, Mr. Shelley Leibowitz, he's been so kind to underwrite our show, and they make it possible for our program, Wild World, to be on the amazing, amazing network of Blog Talk Radio.
I don't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. people stopping staring. I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Oh, oh.
He's called the Super Ranger, Yellowstone Ranger, Bob Jackson. Wild World on Blog Talk Radio patrolled the Thoroughfare District, one of the most remote areas in the entire country, by himself hunting poachers. Absolutely unbelievable. And as we know, the legend himself arrested more poachers than all the rangers combined in Yellowstone National Park. I mean, he was a man out to save this wonderful ecosystem, and we're so happy, so proud to have him on this week's edition of Wild World, the legendary Bob Jackson. Hi, Bob.
It's hard to talk. My head is so swelled up right now. I can't get the tongue to come out. But we'll see what we can do. I'll shrink the head down after your introduction like that. So go ahead.
I will tell you, we're not going to do it right now, but a little later on in the program, I have some sounds that were recorded in Washington I want you to listen to and get your input. Yeah, we'll do that a little bit. But Bob has been on our show. And of course, he talks about his sighting of Bigfoot in Yellowstone National Park. And the last time he was on, he was telling us about the caves and the mountains in Yellowstone and the different wildlife that lives in these caves. And many people don't even realize are there. But on our discussions earlier this week when we were planning our program, Bob says, well, let's talk about poachers because, you know, I think it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, what a life you have. I mean, first of all, we want to say thank you for, you know, they talk about service in the Army and Navy and Marines and so forth. But I think the Park Ranger service is very, very important as well to save these wild lands. And you've done such an admirable job. And explain to people exactly what these poachers were doing that was so bad.
Yeah. It's exploitation. It's a mining of the resources. It's basically when you're doing something like that, all the poachers or outlaws or, you know, whatever they wanted to be called, because they really did identify themselves as outlaws. Most of them did. It was more of their culture that was making them do this. Even though they were guides for the outfitter camps outside the park, they would relish going into the park just so they could get away with it. And so as far as the way these guys thought, you know, it was endemic in the whole system down there. And everything was, of course, horses. And horses and, you know, I was near the south boundary. They were right outside in the Bridger-Teton and then the Washakie Wilderness area on the east side. That whole southeast corner, it was about 45 miles that they could come in from. But they didn't limit it to just, you know, everybody used to call it Rangers Boundary Patrol. Well, that meant that they'd stay on the line and just go back and forth, you know, kind of like a guard would do in the military, going back and forth and, you know, staying right there. But it's so easy for them to go through, you know. I had probably... I don't know. I probably patrolled an average each year of 1,500 square miles. And so if you're the only ones in there, you know, it's a tough so you're not getting them all. All you're doing is you're keeping it down somewhat. But before me, like in the Thoroughfare, that country I was, we had the logbook entries back to 1939. And there was only one person caught in all those years, even though the Rangers would stay back there in the fall and stuff like that. It was it was easier to identify as cowboys and horsemen, kind of like this one well-known ranger that was looked up to. He'd say, we're not much different than them. We all ride horses. But riding horses meant if you bonded with that culture, then you really couldn't do much. And in that 39 years, or since 1939 to when I came in there, I guess came into Dodge, so to speak, in the early 70s, they caught one poacher. And that was an old guy from Kentucky. Him and his son got lost, and they shot a moose right in the corner of the thoroughfare buck and rail fence pasture. And that was it. And when I was came in, you couldn't go, I don't know, a quarter of a mile along that whole boundary unless it was real too steep or something, that you didn't see all the bones from all the elk that had been killed all the years before, you know, where they chopped off the skull plate and take the cape, and then, you know, they head out. You leave all the carcass right there. But so when I first started, I thought, well, I got to take care of this real obvious problem right here, which was, in a way, was easy pickings. You know, a lot of that area, if you staked out or something, you could hear shots. And so, you know, as long as you could go fast on a horse and get there before they got the elk out, then you could actually catch them. You know, you'd have to get the drop on them. But those type of guys weren't the really bad guys, so to speak. They're not going to shoot you, even though they're all armed. But it all was, the poacher patrol was, it wasn't like game wardens where you get tips from the public and everything else. It was all generated by yourself. But you had maybe three different types of poachers. Those that were doing the border raids, you know, right across the line and up to a couple miles. And then you get the guys that would maybe go in 7-8 miles or so and make little, you know, hole-in-the-wall type camps with their horses. And they'd do all the poaching out of there, and then they'd kind of wait around. They might even be there for 4 or 5 days. Doing the poaching. And then you had your professional types that were basically were outlaw gangs. Those were the guys that would, and I never did catch those guys. It wasn't because I couldn't have caught them, but there's just too many type A personalities and the rangers desperate to keep their job. So they kind of wreck it. But there was one group of poachers, and they were out of the Cody area, east of there. And they would come in on horses from the east side of the park, and then they would have a boat, a big white boat, that would come in the middle of the night, and then they would pack out these elk, because in the Delta area, the southeast arm of Yellowstone Lake, there's a herd of 300 elk that never leave Yellowstone. So you got a lot of royals and, you know, 7x8 racks. The biggest elk anywhere around were there. So those were the guys that would, you know, you'd have to keep all the guys that were interior poachers. You know, it'd take, you know, years, not oodles of years, but at least 3-4, because you'd have to see where they were camping, you know, where their lookout guys were up on the sides of the mountain, making sure no one was coming. The big white boat, they'd see it one time, Bridge Bay Marina coming in, 2 or 3 in the morning, where some ranger would be on road patrol. And, you know, they'd just talk to them. You know, they acted like nothing was wrong because the ranger didn't know it. Or they would go out on, it's kind of like a boat ramp on the Mary Bay on the east shore before you go over Sylvan Pass. And, you know, I'd have information. I knew when they were doing it. It was right towards the end of August each year. They wanted to wait, of course, until the elk were out of velvet. But I was supposed to. We were setting it all up. I knew pretty much where they were, where they'd hang out in the willows for 3, 4, or 5 days down there in the Delta area. But then I went back to Iowa to set the farm up for 10 days, and I came back, and they'd already had the guys up there in both areas, you know, along the sides and of the mountains with glass and down. And then after about 2 days, they got antsy, and they sent somebody down on a horse just to make sure to find out if there were poachers there, which you know, it blows everything. You know, you don't ever leave a track in those type of situations. You know, you got to be ready to go. Anyway, so that was one that I never did get, and I imagine they're still poaching in Yellowstone, doing the same thing. So I did get a professional poacher. It'd be kind of sort of like Cecil the Lion guy, except for this guy knew a lot more. I'm kind of doing a monologue. I'll let you ask some questions, and then I'll tell you about
that. No, go ahead, Bob. No, go ahead. We enjoy your conversation. He's an amazing storyteller, a fantastic voice, by the way.
Yeah.
Bob Jackson.
This is a guy in his 50s, and if you look on the southeast corner of Yellowstone, the map and the contours, you'll see an area called the Trident Plateau.
Mm-hmm.
The thoroughfare cabin is probably just about 7,900 feet, and this goes up to over 10,000 feet. And it's the largest alpine tundra area in Yellowstone. And you got several different drainages that go up on top. And once you get on top up there, you can go just about most of a day on your horse, and you're moving pretty fast. And, you know, you're barely going to get to some place where you can get off of there by the end of the day. And then you're going a lot of night riding off of some of those areas. And you got to make sure you don't get caught up in the cliffs, because most all that country up there is, there's only a couple, three ways to get on and off of that big Trident Plateau. In fact, one time I got caught in up there with what you call popcorn snow.
Yeah.
It was really wind-driven. And a horse, if it's a lot of high wind, especially if you got some hail, or popcorn snow like that, it can't lead you back. It can't go. So you're just stuck up there on a situation like that. And, of course, it's whiteout situation because you're up in the clouds, and you really don't know if you're going to make it. That was one of the closest times that I had that I actually was real close to shooting my horse. And, you know, like they say, the old-timers, you got to get inside. And luckily, I mean, that sounds kind of like Western and cowboyish, you know, the old West, but that's about what I had to do, my greatest horse. But this guy here had just hunted the blue ram in the Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
He was in his 50s. He was a headquartered out of California, and he actually was a fire chief, which they could rack up lots and lots of hours and days and months. And that's what this guy would do, because he would just hunt all over the world. And in this case, he had hired on as a guide for one of the camps just so he could get his son, who also worked in the fire departments as a chief. And the son was probably about 30 years old, but he'd never gone hunting with his father. You know, because his father basically, you know, he was, you know, a lot of self-interest, you know, where, you know, it'd be kind of like my uncle when I was young. All of us would go pheasant hunting, you know, pheasant on Thanksgiving. But one of the uncles, he just wanted to get the pheasant so much, he'd run ahead of everybody and shoot it, you know, before the rest of us could get there. So his father was finally going to show his son and how to hunt. You know, and of course, big game is, you know, the Trident. He already knew all about the big country up there. And some of the Trident is out of the park and some of it is in. But, you know, anything in the fall, your elk are going to be down off the tops of those things in the bowls of the upper reaches of those drainages. Where there's, and then you start getting trees. Because up on top, there are no trees.
Right.
It's beautiful, beautiful, big country, and you can see the mountains for 75 miles away. But if I could get up there 3-4 times a year. But anyway, that's a stakeout location. I had 4 different stakeout locations that were remote, where, you know, your cabins are like 12 to 16 miles apart, and I'd have 6 of those, and maybe close to 100 mile circles you could make on those things. But some of those areas you can never get to by doing day patrol out of a cabin. So you'd have stakeout camps, and we'd always made stakeout camps you know, I'd pack a couple 55-gallon barrels up to some of these areas with rims on the top, you know, lids, heavy barrels, and then you'd put your, you know, your horse feed, you'd put your, you know, your wall tent, a couple military cots, a Coleman lantern, a couple gallons of white gas, and a sheep herder stove. In other words, if you're camping out 7 to 10 days, you just can't stay in a small tent, not with that cold of weather. You just got to have something better than that. So we'd always, I had four places, and I caught poachers and all, and it's kind of like running a trap line. I caught poachers in three out of those four of them over the years. But this one was on what you call the upper Trident area, up behind the cabin. And this one, we had to take horses up with all the, because I had a venture capitalist friend that used to be a ranger, and he'd go with me into the backcountry for those 7 or 10 day patrols. He'd take off from work in Chicago and come out. I really couldn't do it with any of the other, you know, regular rangers. You know, whether they're type A personalities or, you know, they just didn't have the patience to really stay in and catch guys. I mean, you know, we made it kind of nice country. We, you know, you took a couple of Playboys and an Architectural Digest with you. You know, you were younger then, so you'd enjoy it too. But then you got to get your horses out of there. Then you got to hike up, you know, 8-10 miles and a lot of elevation. And then you have your day packs, and then you're going incognito. In other words, you're not even wearing ranger uniforms hardly, or coats over top of it is what you're doing, because up there it's so high and so open that you really can't, if other people see you, you can't let them know you're a ranger. You got to think that they got to think you're just another poacher up there. And in fact, one of the guys, the reason we got up close to them is because they thought we were other poachers. But the father had gone down. The son had done the glassing up above about 800, 900, maybe 1,000 feet up, directed his father to where the elk were, which, of course, were well down into Yellowstone Park in the borders. And they shot one. And they got the elk rack out. And that night, and then they actually came back for some of the meat. I was very much surprised that they did that. They'd take the cape and skull plate, but a grizz had been on it, so they really couldn't have got much. But that one, we saw them coming. We were glassing, and so we just ran and ran for probably about 2 miles because, you know, it's on foot. So you can actually get up to them before they got down into the woods in the park, because then you may not be able to find them, at least not in time for that day. So they kept saying, you know, because we intercepted them, and they kept trying to show for about 3-4 hours, yeah, the elk must be around here, you know, somewhere outside the park. And finally, you know, it was getting so late in the day, they had to get off the mountain, and we had to get off, but we were willing to stay. And so finally they broke down, and the father just was on this real steep slope, and he put his leg up onto a rock and put his head down, and he started crying. I mean, this is a professional hunter, worldwide hunter. This is a guy that's done everything all over the whole world, and that's what his whole identity was. But he finally broke. You know, because they all have lots of stories, and I've only had one poacher that never that didn't cry, and that was a pathological liar that I caught dragging elk out of Yellowstone. That was one of the close-in border raids, and then he shot a mountain lion in the park way out. I caught him for that, but he is a pathological liar. But this guy here, he finally broke, and so we just got the confession real quick. I just pulled my little notebook out of my pocket, and you get it. And in this case, it was like several others, actually. When they're crying and they're trying to write confessions and it gets too wet, the page does, you actually got to tear it off and start over again. And you just have them write it. And you get some great confessions. I was in Yellowstone. I knew I was hunting in Yellowstone because I was hunting here before. Things like that, you know. Or like one guy, he said, my father made me drag the elk out with the outfitter, you know. And that was a guy 26 years old. And he says, I didn't want to do it, but they made me, you know. So there.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, then you get out of there. You can't, you know, like we had to, everybody had to rush. And I told him, I said, we'd see him the next day in the outfitter camp, which was straight off the mountain where they were. It was in what they call Open Creek. And but we couldn't make it back. We had about 5 miles to go to get back to our wall tent. And there's no way you can get back because it's all vertical cliffs. Maybe today if you had something that would track your route, you could do it. But you didn't know because you had to end up going down the mountainside to get to the wall tent. But
sure,
if you go off the wrong top of that top, you know, the bowls and everything, you can get hung up and then you're exposed to the weather all night. So the only thing we could do is just head down what is called Escarpment Creek, which has got a lot of timber, a lot of running water that's fast, a lot of grizzly bears in that drainage. But we just took off running until we got down into the heavier stuff. And then we had about 4 or 5 hours where you're just feeling your way along and you're yelling because you don't want to surprise a bear, but the bears can't hear you either because of all the water. So it was a dangerous situation, but we got in about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning back to our cabin. And then we got on the horses the next morning and then we circled around. That was probably about a 15-mile ride, you know, just cold, snow, blowing, that kind of environment. And we got back and we went to the camp. And of course, everybody in the camp knew why we were there. And the father and the son, they were out on this campfire, you know, where you had these logs that are laying around the campfire and, you know, enough for 15 or 20 people to sit around. And it was just, they had the fire going back there, and it was probably 100 feet away from the main, all the tents and stuff, maybe a little further. And it was just, the fire was just blowing sideways, and the snow was just blowing, and the son was on one side of the fire, and the father was on the other. And so probably they were 15, 20 feet apart from each other. And so, you know, we'd already had the confession, but then, you know, you just do your regular start, and then you just started, you just basically, you know, you ask him for the rifle. And, of course, he had his rifle back there with him. It's his Seiko, a Seiko rifle. He'd hunted with that thing all over the world. And when I asked him for the, right before I asked him, the son started sobbing on the other side. And he'd never hunted before. This was the first time his dad had ever taken him out in all those years. And he was, like I say, that guy, the son was a fire chief in one of the districts there. And I don't know, I can't think of what town it was in California. One of the big ones, L.A. or San Francisco. And so then I asked the father for his Seiko, and he handed it to me. He had it, and he's holding it in his hands like he didn't want to give it up. And I said,
"Sure,
you got to give me your rifle." And then he started crying. And then I said, "You know, I said I need your box of ammo too. I need your ammo because we got to match things up." And he had his ammo there in his parka, and I didn't know he'd have it right there, but I guess he didn't want anything back where all the people were, you know, in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
So he had it all right there. And when he gave me the box of ammo for that Seiko, then he just really started crying. And then all at once the son starts coming across and the father starts coming across and they meet right by the fire and they're just hugging and sobbing and crying at each other. And you got a situation where it's just blowing snow and cold as hell and you got a fire that's just going sideways and ash is going all around and here they are just crying away. That was a $3,000 citation I got for him. I don't know whatever happened to the guy. I don't know if it changed him. Most everybody, you hope it changes, but for them, it was just mostly a matter of, you know, the father and the son, you know, and it's really a tragic story in a way, but I don't know. I used to think that these guys would change, but most of the people that you catch poaching, you know, they'd be really remorseful or whatever you want to call it. But then 2 weeks later, they hate you. You know, and then that's when they try to poison your horses and spread porcupine quills in the roll spots for the mules. So, you know, I hope the guy changed, but heck, his whole life was all going all around the world. So he would have to change a lot. So
Man.
He was probably mostly crying because of his son. Well, he's crying because he had the Seiko rifle I had to give him, too, that he had, we had to take. And, of course, we wanted to keep it in Thoroughfare. You know, the judge said, you know, we could have it, you know, after the case was over with. And, you know, so we could use it for patrolling out of the backcountry. But, of course, all the front country administrative types, you know, they'd hear about it, and they wanted some trophy of it. So they, same as a mountain lion, you know, they just... They want to. In fact, we got all M14s for every one of our cabins for a dollar from the government, the military, where I had, where in case you got a bear in the middle of the summer or sometime and somebody comes in and says that, you know, Grizz is, or bear's on the guy or his buddy, then you've got a rifle you can go with. And by the end of 3 years, they had them all, they had five of the six of them were in the front country, the Lake Ranger Station. They'd taken them out and they put them in there because they thought it was a good military gun, you know. So it wasn't really, so who knows what happened. Anyway, that's one poacher story. You were starting to ask something, Larry. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's, first of all, my question is, how do you have to haul them out of there? Is that, or what's, how's that involved? I mean, you don't have a paddy wagon back here in the middle of nowhere.
Actually, I never did, actually. I have put, you know, because you always carry flexicuffs in your ranger hat, and I have, you're not supposed to legally do it, but I have flexicuffs them to trees. But, you know, if you got three or four guys, and everyone's armed with pistols, 44s, and they all got rifles, so everybody's armed. Everything, I'm armed. Everybody's armed in a situation back there. But you always take your rifles. If it's like if I'm on horses, you always take all the rifles, and then you leave them one pistol, and then you let them go out, like if you know where they're from, because if a horse breaks a leg or something, then at least they don't have to use an axe to try to kill it with an axe, which Trail Crew used to did that a couple times, and it's awful to have to use an axe. So you do always leave them with a pistol. And so then they can shoot their horse. But as far as the, if you're anywhere near, most of the areas you don't have radio communication. Like I had no radio communication on this case. It wasn't until we got back to the cabin in the middle of the night, and then you let them know the next morning, because you got an antenna tower, you know, for your, you know, your park radio, and then you tell them what happened. But if it's anywhere, like if three, four guys and. You know, most of those guys, you know, they're getting their racks and they're, you know, they always want to have some token amount of meat that they're taking with them out of the park. You know, the guys that are camping for 3-4 days, usually the bears is what kicks them out. If the bears are thick like they are in Mountain Creek, you know, they're all scared as hell by the time they're out of that drainage. And so,
good for them.
So, but so a lot of their meat's already gone. You know, they'll... hang their meat and stuff like that. But if you can get a helicopter in, you know, you have a stash of that stuff with the guns and their panniers, stuff like that. If it's some of the cases, you know, I'd always take pictures of their horses and their saddles, stuff like that. And then if a judge let us, then we'd confiscate, you know, we'd, they'd have to turn over their horses and their saddles and stuff like that. One guy out of Jackson, he was a bad dude poacher. He was a real bad one. I mean, I'd never hear who these guys were. You know, game wardens didn't really want me to catch people because that made them look bad. So they wouldn't tell me about the real badasses that were out there. But I'd find out them, and then you'd, you know, the one guy, he was a roper as well as a poacher, and you know, they all worked as guides or former guides for the outfitter camps. You know, unless you had a professional poacher like that guy I just told you about with him and his son. They went. But otherwise, you just, that guy, I knew it was a Porter saddle, but he he all at once said the thing was stolen. So he had to give $1,200 for his saddle, you know, to keep his saddle, basically, because he didn't want to give that up. He gave up three horses that were really, really good, you know, and then they had to give up their rifles. But I don't know. I'd just soon take their shoes off and let them try to walk out. If it was my my way of doing it, I mean, they're all up there in the boonies, so, you know, why give them an opportunity to get out of there? But you give them. So I never really had to. You know, the ones that are flexicuffs, you know, once you get the people all sort, because everybody, you got to separate them. If there's three, four guys and they're on the run and they're trying to get ahead of you, and then you separate them. And it's just like the movies is what it is, but you get them separated, and then you say, you stay over here, you stay there, because the first off, what you do when you're coming in on guys is you let them get their alibis. If they have alibis, you know, like they all have stories as to why they're there, something to cover what they're really there. So you let them go through those stories, and that may take 2-3 hours. Even if you're right there and you got them, you know, dead to rights. So then you, after the stories are done, and then the energy levels, you see, you're just out there in the boonies and way in the mountains. That's what they are. And it's just like, it's just me against them.
And
I don't know, maybe my convictions were more, but I always had more energy. And like the guy that, you know, that poacher, that professional guy, you know, they were worried about getting off the mountain. And so, you know, finally they just had to. They just broke because of that, because they wouldn't have been able to get off the mountain either. So we couldn't get back. I wasn't going to tell them where our camp was, because then they tell the outfitter where your stakeout is, and then, you know, you don't have that for a good crop of poachers the next year, so to speak. So anyway, it's...
What a job.
Yeah, there wasn't any... we didn't take them in, you know, rope them to a saddle like they do in the movies. I never had to do that. I mean, I had some bad dudes. But once you got them, once you had the breakdown stories, you break down their stories, and then they all cried because the gig was up. And they just had no energy left. They just almost collapsed to the ground is what they would do. In fact, probably a good third of them, when they broke, they go to their knees. One guy, well, I don't know how much time we got. There's a lot of stories. We can do a lot of stories.
We're going to have to. We're running out of time quickly. I do want to play this for you real quick, though, Bob. This was recorded out of the state of Washington. I may have to call you. We may run out of time here, but this was recorded out of the state of Washington, and it was recorded on a macro cassette, so the quality is not really good. And you can hear birds and so forth, but you can hear these distinctive screams. And I want some real quick insight. Let's see if we can get this to go here. There we go. Bob?
Yeah, I could hear it. It was a little scratchy. The difference, I'd hear it's the same thing on mine the two times that I heard, which I'm sure was a Bigfoot. But, you know, I'd said to always describe it as like a Tarzan, you know, just going on and on and on. And this one does sort of sound like a Tarzan type, but mine would never stop. It sounded like in this one that it would at least go down in volume quite a bit and then go back up in volume. But, you know, it's just like humans, you have a lot of different sounds. Mine would just be like Tarzan going forever, and or like a thousand elk going to their death. You know, just and just kept going. Yeah. And to me, it's like, how could any animal have that kind of a lung capacity to have keep going? And the second time I timed it, and cause as soon as I heard it, I knew what it was. And I think it was 26 seconds long. And this one, you got there, they're doing it. A lot of the same sounds that I heard, But they're making the sound, you know, like but then they a split second later, then they're doing the same thing again. So, but I think it doesn't mean that it's any different. It just means that they, you know, the reason for their saying what they did, you know, those Bigfoot, it would be different than what they were doing for mine. Mine
we
got to
go.
A tragic. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll talk.
We ran
later.
Out of time.
Okay.
All right, Bob.
Okay, bye.
You've been listening to Wild World.
Hi, everyone. This is Shelley Leibowitz. You're listening to my friend Larry Batson's Wild, Wild World on Bob Talk Radio.